Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. I'm delighted to share in conversation today with two artists and the curator from the show currently on view at Stay Home Gallery, our brick and mortar space that is a gallery in residency in rural Tennessee. Our curator, Tara Carpenter Estrada, traveled from her home in Utah to put together and install this show that she titled Together Alone. And it will be installed through mid-June. And today, Tara and I are joined by two artists from the show who have work that Tara especially loved. We're going to hear about their work, their practices, and we're going to have a conversation about caregiving and art. So I just want to welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, artist and curator Tara Carpenter Estrada, and our two artists featured today, Hannah Foster and Kate Windley. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you so much, Kaylin.
Of course. Okay, so I'm going to go through, instead of me reading a long monologue of introducing you, when it's a panel, I like to just have you kind of share a bit about yourselves with our listeners. So why don't you set us up and tell us a little bit about who you are, where you live, and kind of what your life looks like during this stage. Of course, I want to start with Tara, our curator, who kind of brought together these artists. Why don't you introduce yourself, Tara?
Thanks, Kaylin. So I'm a professor of art education at Brigham Young University, and that's in Provo, Utah. So I live there with my family. I have two children, a 17-year-old that's graduating from high school and preparing to go to college, and a 3-year-old. My husband, Nick, is the primary caregiver in our family. I work full-time and he works part. Anything else?
We'll get to your art a little later, but that was perfect for now, Tara. Thanks. Let's go to Kate. Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Kate Windley from Athens, Georgia, and I am an assistant professor at the University of North Georgia on the Coney campus, which is a small regional campus. I teach in the foundations program, so I teach freshmen, and I'm also raising a child with a severe disability, and he's 11, so I spend a lot of time as a faculty, full-time working mother, full-time caregiver. But I've spent 2 years in Latin America. I speak some Spanish, and I'm learning how to sew right now.
Awesome. Great to have you, Kate. And then Hannah, would love to have you introduce yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So I live in Minneapolis. I kind of jumped around before landing here after graduate school a few years ago. And I work for a nonprofit called Fresh Eye Arts that supports artists with disabilities. And I run their art employment program. So I'm supporting artists in doing all the challenging things of being an artist, applying to exhibitions, running a small business. And then I also teach in the community as well. I teach business skills for artists occasionally. Awesome.
Awesome. Thanks, Hannah. Okay, so I want everybody to describe what kind of art you make so that as we're kind of talking, folks can have that in the back of their mind. And then I'm going to have Tara talk a little bit about the show and like her inspiration for putting together this show. And then we'll get into the nitty gritty of your different practices and talk about art and caregiving. So I'll take it back to you, Tara, because you're also an artist as well as, curating this show for us and having curatorial experience. Do you want to talk a little bit about your practice and what you make?
Yeah. So I still consider myself a ceramic artist. That's what I went to school for. And I do make ceramic art. But in the last couple of years with a newborn and the pandemic, I shifted the way that I work. And so most of my work that you'll see on Instagram or wherever is painted paper collage and digital work right now.
Awesome. Thank you, Kate.
Yeah, so I like to switch mediums. I like to kind of generate the idea first and then sort of move towards the medium. But I'm trained in drawing. I'm a figurative drawer. But recently I've been really interested in like reincorporating art in my body, like performance, but then also a product of clothing. So I've been learning how to make clothing with self-drawn drawings and screen printing. And so it's kind of like moving into more of like wearing your art to Kroger's or taking it to the, as a product of the pandemic, I think we're all trying to figure out how to reinvent our practices and make pigment out of Georgia dirt. I'm really interested in like process from the very beginning. And I'm quilting.
Awesome. Got your hands in lots of things. I like it. All right, Hannah, what about you? Can you describe your art and your practice a bit for us?
Yes. So I love looking at trash or items that people are throwing out along dumpsters, especially, you know, strange plastic things or clothes. I'm always looking for textures and different materials. I go to a lot of thrift stores and, you know, resale shops to find a lot of the objects that I'm inspired by. And so I kind of have two different processes. So that's more for sculpture. So I'll kind of have the objects and I'll make the connections with the objects I have. I'm not really somebody who can just have ideas in my head. I kind of have to visually see what's going on and what I'm doing. So that's more for sculpture. And more recently I've done a lot of collage and drawing. And that kind of starts with little thumbnail sketches, and I create, kind of build on that, but definitely a big influence in body horror. I really like, usually there's a lot of appendages in my art, but also really bright colors. So I really like this clash between, how I've described it is kind of, like a benign uncomfortability. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that it's not dangerous. It kind of looks like a stuffed animal or something, but why is it so weird? And that's kind of the clash that really excites me that I try to strive for with my work.
Oh, I think a lot of artists are into that sort of, you know, is this weird or cool? I don't know. Yeah.
That's awesome. Actually something I really liked about both of your work is that it kind of rode that line between something that's like a comforting object, but also sort of disturbing in some way. I thought that was really interesting and cool.
Tara, why don't you go ahead and describe the theme of the show and maybe your inspiration behind it? Like, what was the call about and why did you pick Together Alone as sort of the inspiration for this show?
Yeah, I mean, I think the title says a lot, that this idea that as caregivers, whether you're a parent or a teacher or someone taking care of people with disabilities, like we're with them all the time. But also there's this feeling of loneliness because it's not on the same level as being with peers or with friends. Mm-hmm. You're with people, but also isolated in some ways. And I think that's a really interesting juxtaposition to like feel like, gosh, I just want to be alone. You know? But also, I mean, you love the people that you're with and you care about them. And there's sort of warmth and love in the togetherness there. Mm-hmm. And so kind of holding those conflicting feelings all at the same time, I think is really rolled up into caregiving. Mm-hmm. So that's what I wanted to think about and explore with all of these pieces that we picked for the show, is just how do people express that idea and that, I don't know, tension in their work and in their lives.
Awesome. Do you want to say anything about the jurying process? Like what kind of themes stood out to you or pieces that stood out to you as you were, or like, what did you learn about either that thematic content or, you know, the ways in which artists are expressing thoughts about caregiving through jurying the show?
Yeah. I mean, one thing I really love about curating is it's like, It's almost like shopping. Like the joyful part of it. I mean, not the stressful paying money for it, but like the like, oh, this is really cool. And this is really cool. And they could go together and that would look really awesome. Mm-hmm. And so it's really kind of joyful curating that way, because it's like, oh, I like this thing and I like this thing. And so I went through the first time and just picked things I liked without any real kind of preconceived, like what's it about? Or, you know, I was just looking at the pictures and saying what looks really cool. And then after that, kind of going through again and thinking about, okay, how do these interact together and how do they relate? And something interesting that happened, this wasn't the curation, but in the installation of the show, is that as Delena, who's my friend that helped install the show, as we started putting places, where we realized, oh, like we're kind of like organizing little theme rooms because they all speak to one another in interesting ways. So like the yellow room ended up being this like fiber love space that I was really excited about. So we had all of these fiber artists that were speaking to one another, especially your two pieces. Just kind of thinking about what sang to me personally, which I know is different for other people. Like I have a style and a thing I like. What arose from that was just ideas about time and intensity. I thought a lot of the fiber art was so time intensive and showed like, what does it mean to care and be with someone? I mean, I loved, Kate, your urine bags on the coat. You know, because it was something that was like, it looked like couture, beautiful, something you would just see in a store, but then you look closer and you realize what's on it. And it has this added depth of meaning. Mm-hmm. Hannah, when I was looking at your work, same kind of thing. It's like cute and cuddly, but then you look closer at it. It's like, oh, this is kind of, there's something almost off about it, you know? which is really kind of great, you know?
Okay, so
rambled, but yeah,
perfect segue, Tara, to have Kate and Hannah describe the pieces in the show. Kate, let's start with you. Can you talk specifically about the piece that was selected and your kind of concepts and inspiration behind it and how you made it?
Yeah, absolutely. I love the way you were describing it, but it is a coat that was, I took a photo of a urine bag. My son has a G-tube, and a lot of times this equipment becomes a big part of who you are. You know, you see it every day and it's attached to your body. You get your nutrition from it. You pee in it. And all of that's to say that I actually had a student that had a urine bag outside of his electric wheelchair, and he would like ride into class and it would jostle around. And I just loved the fact that there was no like hiding of that apparatus as part of identity. And I just wanted like the clothing to kind of be a little bit of like a secret power. So the true vision of the urine bag is in the inside of the coat. And of course, the person who wears it knows it's there if you're wearing it out in public. And the exterior is like an abstracted version of it, because actually there's so much beauty in medical equipment. If you've ever been to the doctor and just been kind of staring around the room and thinking, wow, these are wonderful colors, like these weird designs and patterns. And it's kind of taboo in society. You can't even take a picture in a hospital. So I love that idea of like taking this symbolism that's kind of like maybe a negative association for a lot of people, but then physically putting it on your body as like an act of either wearing the jacket, like kind of like empathy towards people who wear these apparatus or things as part of their lives, and like body acceptance, or like, as you said, body horror. Like there's this kind of acceptance and horror both at our fragility. So I was like really interested in it as being clothing and being something that, you know, you could wear alongside someone else who might have an accommodation. That was my inspiration.
Had you made like a piece of clothing before, or was that a skill you kind of learned because you wanted this piece specifically to be a jacket?
It's the second article of clothing, but the first one was a dirt suit. So printing dirt and wearing like dirt, again, subverting what we think is beautiful, what sustain. And then this was this very new medium, and it was absolutely idea driven, just wanting to get art out of a gallery or out of like into the public and then back in a gallery again. And just kind of that dialogue of being like able to wear it after a show. And so I'm so glad you liked it.
Yeah, and I love the way that it's installed on a hanger, like kind of, you know, giving it this form of somebody wearing it or it existing as, you know, an actual jacket like it's supposed to, rather than just, you know, kind of tacked to a wall in a 2D way. It's really interesting. Hannah, do you want to talk about your piece? You have two pieces in the show. And, you know, kind of their inspiration and how they relate to the theme of the show.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting, I think, that both pieces were chosen because I'm constantly thinking about relationships in terms of my work. So whether it's relationships to materials, relationships to me and the objects, or even just the history of objects, I have this this narrative that I come up in my head about the life of this object and how it existed. So there's just having that to me is a lot of emotion in it. And at the same time I was working on these, there started being some like kind of traumatic event after traumatic event in my family. So this was a very slow process of me just kind of making these, not really sure what I'm doing. And the series ended up being a lot more subtle than a lot of my work. And to me that shows, you know, I have a lot of work that's bright colors and kind of has this quality of joyful, bright, almost absurd. And this came out a little bit more subtle. And I really think that kind of relayed the caretaking that I also do in my family. So my mom is older and she's had a lot of health problems, and I'm definitely a foundation in my family. So I'm very much managing my two siblings, you know, and their emotional state, as well as my mother and what's going on with her, along with just the actions from day to day. So, you know, I was reflecting on, she's a retired RN, and there's just a series of caregivers of women. I have some great aunts who are them, and it's just come down, you know, and then I'm in social work, and just thinking about that kind of generational caregiving as I'm there sewing, doing, you know, traditional women's work, sewing these shapes. And, you know, even watercolors can kind of, to me at least, and this might be my own perception, have this really like, it's soft, it's gentle, it's not going to be anything overwhelming, and kind of bringing those together while I'm reflecting on all of these almost long-term scars or traumas from having to caretake. And there's so many joys involved in caretaking, and there's also so many challenges. And for me, I think it really, just making those artworks really helped me process some of what I was experiencing in terms of navigating life and the unexpected events that happened. And saying all this, you know, to me, looking at the artwork, this stuff does not come across. This is just what's going on in the background. But when you see it, it's like, oh, that looks cute. It's got a, you know, it's got a fun stuffed shape, and, you know, there's little stitches, and it's kind of cute. And that's also part of that, that dichotomy and that contrast that I really love, is that the accessibility of it to enjoy it is really broad. And that's also something that comes up a lot in my work, because I want a child to be able to enjoy it. But if you want to hear about the complexities behind the theory and what I'm going through in it, I'm happy to share that. And I love being able to move and create artwork along that scale.
Beautiful, Hannah. I mean, I think something I think about in my work is just the very act of making a piece of art is an expression of care, right? Because you're like literally pouring energy, concept, thought, physical, tangible, you know, momentum into an object. And I mean, I think obviously there's varying degrees to which artists want a message to kind of come through within a piece of work. But I don't know, like, I think particularly with textile-based work, I just look at something and you can't not see the thread, like, kind of being woven through it, you know?
Yeah. Well, they also carry ideas of, like, warmth and comfort with them when you use fabric. And that's kind of why I wanted to talk to y'all, because, like, you, all of you, Kaylin, you too, are, like, making works that use fabric that has a past or a history and, like, so when you look at the art, like, even if you don't know the backstory, like, you can see this sort of comfort that comes with it. Does that make sense?
Mm. Hannah, I was wondering if you would talk a little bit more about, you know, being a caregiver who is not a parent. I think, you know, having this podcast, Artist Mother, and kind of creating a platform for artists to talk about caregiving, it just very naturally falls into conversations about parenting and motherhood. But I've tried, and I'm sure can do a better job, but also open to the ways in which, you know, really the idea is more that artists are caregivers, and that, you know, I mean, I feel like just being a human, you're going to exhibit some type of care, but I know through your job and the ways in which you've cared for your parents, like you mentioned, you have some very specific caregiving roles. Do you want to talk about, and you touched on this a little bit, but I would love for you to go more in depth about the ways in which caregiving influences your life and your art practice.
It's a very interesting balancing game. I think I have the utmost respect for parents who are, you know, parents to children, raising children. And that's not something at this point in my life I've chosen for myself. But something that's become apparent over my years of mostly going to therapy or doing internal work is that we end up embodying these roles in our family units, depending on how close we are. So from a young age, I became a parent, particularly to my mother. So I was the role, I was the enforcer. I was the one that said X, Y, and Z had to be done. And I think in some ways that we all have that. We have the, you know, whatever our default role as a child was, and it can, without a lot of awareness, it can really come out even when everyone's an adult. And that to me has been a real challenge to figure out how to balance that. It's not always just this direct, you know, assisting you with physical needs, you know, eating. It's the emotional, the emotional caregiving that takes so much time and introspection to learn how to do, because our culture itself doesn't have a strong emphasis on that. Western culture in general has a very external perspective on accomplishing X, Y, and Z, having success that looks like X, Y, and Z, American dream, whatever that is. So, to pursue the role of caregiver in this more emotional way has been, especially not having learned the skills until I was an adult, has been very very taxing. And I do it similarly in my day-to-day job. So, you know, working with vulnerable adults and caring for individuals with disabilities, there's a certain relationship that there's a certain role you're playing and there's a certain role that they're playing. And ideally you're meeting each other on an equal plane, but sometimes you're having to adjust the way you communicate or how you would normally speak about something. And that can also be really depleting, because it's almost like I can't be my actual self in terms of how I want to express and the words I want to use. And it's extremely rewarding in a sense of being able to see someone succeed because you were able to adjust the way that you interact with them for them to understand and then accomplish a goal. So beautiful and so wonderful. And I imagine that similar, you know, with children, watching a child have, you know, a first step or read for the first time. So in some ways I feel like I get certain angles of being a parent, but not actually a parent, being a, you know, a biological parent or having adopted a child.
I feel like you do a lot of the hard work, but you don't get the kid snuggles.
I know.
I hope you've got some pets or something that just, you know.
I do. And I do get lots of hugs. I'm very much generally optimistic and pretty outgoing and kind of strange. So I get a lot of hugs when I go to different day programs and things. But I do try my best to spend time around kids if I can, because we usually get along within, you know, 30 seconds. Like we're friends.
which is not to suggest that there are not rewards for caregiving outside of young kids, but just that kind of, I mean, I really resonate with what you were saying in the idea of parenting being a role, not necessarily an identity, right? Like a role that can be learned, and caregiving as being something that maybe you learn through survival or through, you know, a specific set of relationships that kind of force you into that experience. And it just made me wonder, like, kind of hearing a bit about your childhood and how you learned sort of these parenting skills early on, like part of me was like surprised that you then went into caregiving as a career, but then also you've learned these skills and it's like, I'm sure a natural fit for you to be so good with, you know, the folks that you work with. And what a joy to combine art with that too, you know, to work with people with disabilities, but to use art as kind of the path or the vehicle to work with them, I think is kind of amazing.
Thanks. Yeah. It's, I mean, I realized just over the last couple of years that part of my choices and comfort in doing this is some trauma from the past. But as long as I know, after knowing that, I make a conscious choice to do what I'm doing, that's what changes and switches. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not doing this because, like you said, out of survival, or it's not a default because I have to. I'm going to make a choice to pursue this path. And that's very empowering. So I can feel really happy in the role that I've chosen.
Hey, let's go to you and have you share a bit about, you know, kind of similarly, this idea of caregiving and how it impacts your art and, you know, the ways that you move through the world. Anything you want to say in response to Hannah, or just share about your own story?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I would first say that I depend on caregivers that are not, you know, necessarily biological parents of my child. I'm, you know, predominantly a single mom caring for this child. And in order to have art at all in my life, somebody, a nurse, comes on Saturday and Sunday and I go work in my studio. So this relationship with my son is a communal one. Speaking of my Hannah, you know, when he grows older, he will outgrow school, but he will still be needing care. You know, the idea of ego mass separation that happens biologically when your child goes through the steps of growth and they grow out of your, it doesn't happen the same way with people with disability. There's still a dependency, but then there's also puberty and, like, you know, relationships and dating. And so other people have to get involved. So I would say that, like, as a parent, like, my ability to make art is contingent upon other people's ability to care about my son. And so it's a really intense way of opening up your home to strangers. Every weekend, there's nurses that come, often from different countries and different backgrounds. But my son has a rare syndrome. He's one of very few in the world, like about 200 or 300. And he's nonverbal, and he has epilepsy. And we didn't get a diagnosis until he was three. So it was kind of hard because the technology and the medical field is just starting to catch up with the needs of particular populations that aren't as common. And as a parent, I've really had to be an advocate, and it's impacted my art because I have to really manage my time well. So I think of a lot of artists who are caregivers, but also people who are even non-artists that are dealing with disabilities. There's this concept of, like, how do we structure our time that makes it important and relevant to have all these social networks, and just specifically mothers or caregivers that are you know, caring for their parents. But in my instance, the most help I've ever gotten has been from other mothers of other children with disabilities who have had children pass. So this idea of, like, loss and grief remanifesting through caring for other mothers. And then essentially there's a lot of medical paperwork, which is why I always make this comparison of, like, we draw on cotton paper, our clothing's made of cotton, our form we send out so they have a, you know, or like the Katie Beckett waiver for Medicaid is also a paper, you know, a paper form. And so there's, like, I think of, like, art as, like, an extension of, I guess, the materiality of this world, whether it's textiles or urine bags or G-tube equipment. I mean, I think of those physical manifestation in actual form. So I took the COVID vaccine consent form and I scanned it into my computer and then I made screens of it. And I'm like printing the COVID consent form all over my clothing. And I'm kind of hoping when I go to the grocery, all I really want is for someone to come up in the grocery store and ask me about something I've subverted, you know, because that idea of it being this universal, one great thing about disabilities is it's such a universal experience that every economic group, every background is impacted. And so if you have a family member or loved one or aging parent in a facility, you might be exposed to groups of people that you would never naturally be exposed to. And that has been such a blessing. And as far as my studio time, like I protect it just like I protect my son as an extension, Kaylin, what you were saying about how like making things is sort of caregiving, you're caring for your object, mm-hmm. also caring for your time. So you get really aware of like this summer, I'm a teacher, I'm off, I'll be caregiving. I only have these little windows to make art, and I'm very aware of how much and how precious that is as an extension of being available then later in the day for my son or in July for my son. So the studio and like the managing of that is just really important to value it. Would be just like you value your person you care for.
Mm, beautiful reflections, both of you. Tara, I just want to, you know, offer any space for you to, I have some thoughts to share, but is there anything you want to say in response?
Oh, I love how all these ideas combine and what you just said about valuing your art, just like you value the other people in your life. Like, oh, like I'm going to be thinking about that, you know, for a while. Thank you.
Well, and I think too, you know, when Tara and I were choosing artists to pick this, pick for this panel, the literal connection between choosing an artist who is not a parent, but who is a caregiver for folks with disabilities, and then Kate, who is an artist of, you know, a child with disabilities, like that wasn't, we just were kind of like, oh, let's pick a couple of the textile artists that we love. And so, yeah. You know, I really appreciate the back and forth between the two of you in this, you know, response, Kate, that you shared about how your own experience of caregiving, it has to be communal for your survival. And you rely on people like Hannah, you know, to give care to your son and to be part of that village experience of, you know, of providing care. And I don't think that's specific to your son having, you know, the specific condition that he has or disabilities, but just like, we need each other. And I just feel like you two being in conversation and your work being in conversation is just a beautiful example of the ways in which, you know, we have to live in community to survive, you know, and so much of caregiving is awareness of our reliance on each other and the ways in which we have to be in community to make art, to, you know, get our kid through school, to give each other love and care and resources, to learn how to reparent ourselves. You know, there's just so much there in this conversation. And I really appreciate the way this has kind of come together.
I thought I was a really independent person until I had a child. And then I realized that all of that, I was just lying to myself, you know, or shortchanging myself too. You know what I mean? Like something about being a caregiver for somebody else makes you realize that you cannot do things alone, mm-hmm. And that you need other people. And I think that's a gift. Mm-hmm. Because then you can bring those other people into your life that, you know, and you have more rich relationships around these people that you really care about. Mm.
So this kind of brings me into another question that I had for all three of you, and a question that I don't think has an answer, as it's one that I am constantly exploring myself. But something I've been thinking about a lot just personally is actually, yesterday, my youngest turned 5. And this fall, you know, this previous August, like this has been his first year in school. And so since August, this has kind of been my first, like, you know, all three of my kids are in school from 8 to 2:30, 3 o'clock every day. And I think, you know, you kind of, like, I remember last summer going into that experience and everyone's like, what are you going to do with your time? Your days are, you know, you're not going to know what to do with yourself, which I just find hilarious. Like as an entrepreneur, like I've been working full time while also being the primary caregiver for my kids. So, you know, I knew exactly what I was going to do with my time, but I guess I did have this perception of myself that suddenly I was going to be more productive almost, like all of the things that I couldn't do. It's like I always felt held back by being the primary caregiver of my kids and having kids at home before they were school age. And so I kind of thought, oh, like, wow, I'm going to, like, I was productive before and now it's going to be like, watch out world. Like I'm going to be doing all these crazy things. And I've really found that that has not been the case. If anything, I am slower. I need much, much more time to get things done, to process. It's like, all I want is just to linger over my coffee, you know? And I think what I've been realizing, even just this week, having my youngest turn 5, is that this year, it's just, it's like I'm remembering who I am, you know? And so all of that to say, to lead into my question is just how do you experience caregiving and so much outpouring consistently while also creating space in your life to know yourself, you know? And like, I feel like that's what I've been doing this past year is like, oh, there you are. Oh, you know, because it was so much focused on my kids. And it's like, I'm just slower. I'm taking my time because I'm like trying to remember who I am, you know, and kind of look at the parts of myself that I haven't been able to give time to for the past 11 years. You know, my oldest is 11. So I know that's like a very long lead in, but I guess I just wanted to bring up this idea of the self. And, you know, there are these real moments where we just don't have time or energy left to give ourselves. And I don't know, I'm just grateful to be coming back into some of that. But I know, you know, Kate and Hannah, both of your experiences are different from mine, but I'm sure this struggle is still there. So do either of you want to jump in with a response? Kate?
Yeah, no, I remember that feeling too. When Leo started kindergarten, it was like, I have these hours and I know I need to be productive. How do I be productive? What's the process of being productive? You know, it was like this kind of, I find the biggest struggle for me actually is when the plans don't go through really well, like COVID, school's closing for a year. And like, I think that the finding yourself amongst this identity is the idea of the ego mass again, like this role we're in requires a crossover of autonomy. And as our children or the people we love that we are responsible for start to move, our autonomy shifts. And for me, my son's nonverbal. So there's this different role where I can still sort of navigate the world because he's sort of easy. And that's the secret. Mm-hmm. He's very easy. He's like a very positive person. I mean, he laughs in his sleep at night. So it's like this kind of little positive, like oxytocin giver that balances like other hectic parts of life. But the question, I'm trying to refer back to this idea of like that moment when you're both of your kids have left home and you're an artist. And I actually find, I know this is crazy, but like these kinds of deadlines, like this exhibit and these communal events to really, for me, are like critical because I'm actually not a real big social media promoter. I value studio time so much that I'm not one of those people that spend like 50% doing other, like even coffee in the morning. It's sort of a critical part of the day, but almost all of those things, for me, it's like always been just making stuff has had to happen. And to do that, if I could just make stuff, I was okay. Like I was going to be okay. I had to take 3 years off when he was born because he has epilepsy. And most people with disabilities, the first 3 years of their life are critical. Like it is not a time to mess around with their care. And I don't know of a single parent who hasn't had to just like stop art or stop their career or stop their dreams or stop their goals because the need is so great. And with any small child, really, but particularly a fragile small child. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of adults or people as their kids age, there's this kind of rediscovery of self, ego mass separation. But conversely, I guess the one difference would be with children with disabilities, you don't actually separate. And your egos are still really entwined, even when they're 40 or 50, if you get that privilege. And so you have to kind of learn with like this constant intertwining. Like, for example, my son still has that baby impulse to like grab your fingers really tight. He never lost it. You know, I still have to help him, guide him in and out of the house. And he can't go from sitting to standing. He can't feed himself. He has in diapers at 11, you know, so they're like these very basic biological things that don't ever evolve. You're kind of cognitively like sort of in the same spot in some ways. I don't know. Did that help you, Kaylin, or did that answer?
No, I think just again, your response is providing just this diversity of experience, you know, that we all need to hear more about and to bring into understanding. Like I have an uncle who, actually my mother is a twin and her twin, you know, is in his 50s and has lived with disabilities his whole life. And, you know, I was thinking of my grandparents, like, as you were talking about this idea of, you know, the identity never really separating because my grandfather passed away 2 years ago. And of course that created this big, you know, kind of experience within the family of, well, Poppy was Sean's primary caregiver, even though Uncle Sean is in his 50s. And I don't know, just that idea of the identity remaining so entwined, which any kind of parent has that experience, any kind of caregiver, but it's, you know, it's to a different degree, right? So just thank you for sharing. And yeah, like your perspective is so needed and valued.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. And I try to avoid like this idea. One thing I've experienced early in parenting was like the non-neurodivergent or neurodivergent were sort of separated in parenting communities unintentionally. Like we have only adult friends just because other kids can't quite understand Leo. They can't, I mean, they love him. He dances all the time. He smiles. When we leave school, they say bye, Leo. But in general, he lives in an adult world, but he's a child. Mm-hmm. So I think what I've been learning is like, and also for parents and non-parents, it's like, we just all have to have a bunch of compassion for each other. I can't imagine having a teenager. I can't imagine having a 17-year-old like you have, Tara. Like, I don't know. I just can't imagine. So like, I think what's so beautiful is as I'm aging myself, I'm seeing, you know, other parents go through it. And I think that it's becoming more universal, I believe, like, for me, as I'm aging, I'm finding, I was going to tell you, really, one of the most important things is who you spend your time with. Like, I think what I've learned as a caregiver is being a little careful about who I let into our lives. But the people I do let in have, like, I'm trying to pick people more carefully. They have superpowers, like, you know, agency, awareness, clarity, compassion, confidence, courage. Like, all of the positive things become so important and so visible.
I would say that's one way that you're caring for yourself is having boundaries around who you let influence your relationships and who you're in community with. I think that's a great reminder in caregiving, Kate. Hannah, I want to give you the opportunity to speak to this idea of kind of the identity of yourself and the ways in which caregiving can, you know, take away from your ability to care for yourself and to, you know, experience your own identity, but also the ways in which, of course, it, you know, encourages those things and provides positivity to you as a as an individual.
I think one of the two things came to mind. So the first one is, which is, I don't know if it's a, you know, a hot word these days, but having boundaries, boundaries around my time and my energy, having emotional boundaries, even in the moment when someone's having some kind of crisis, knowing that I have a choice on how to respond to that. I might feel overwhelmed to an extent, but I can also say, how do I want to express that to this person and be able to, you know, have some distance and not totally absorb whatever the chaos is. That's something that's been very important to me and kind of gives me that autonomy whenever, you know, I'm going through caregiving in my day-to-day life, just not totally enmeshing with whatever emotional chaos is happening. And also just boundaries around, yeah, time. So, you know, my family knows that at dinner time and later, I don't have my phone available and I'm not available to talk. That for me is just a mental health choice. And that allows me to not fall deep into that role of caregiver and lose my identity totally, because all I'm doing is adhering to the needs of others. The other thing that came up, and this kind of relates to Kaylin, what you were saying about, you know, being slower and moving through through moments where you thought, yeah, I'm going to be so productive, it's going to be great, and then, you know, you just don't do that. And I try to look at those moments as, because I'm similar, you know, I call what I've been doing for the last couple of years slow art, because I don't have as much time to sit for 4 hours and just work on something. There's other self-care, you know, exercise, cooking dinner, etc. So looking at the longer term process, so not the success that I can have in the next couple of months, you know, being in exhibitions or making sales or whatever success might look like at that time. I'm looking at the large scale of life as an artist, and would I rather consciously and carefully and in the moment complete 5 pieces, or would I rather rush and kind of be stressed out and not feel so good and complete these things really fast and then look in retrospect and say, you know, I made those things, but I didn't feel good or really enjoy that process. And there's always moments of discomfort and frustration when you're making, but as a whole, that can still have some moments of, you know, you can still kind of be in a good place with that. And that's something that I've, with making, have over the last few years, have really had to remind myself, especially going from the contrast of being in the studio and a lot more time and then switching and having to balance so many life responsibilities. I also think about, I love sleep and I love taking naps. And I have to look at that as well as part of my individual recovery and part of my identity that's going to make me a more whole person, so that I can show up and fulfill my art practice and I can fulfill the support needs for the individuals I work with and for my family. And knowing that when I say no, it's not because I don't care or I don't want to help. It's that, you know, I am going to feel worse if I say yes to this. This isn't going to be a good choice for me to be able to show up, because I don't want to agree to do something if I'm half there, unless it's an emergency or something, of course. But if it's something that there's an option for, I'm not going to compromise myself and my well-being as much as possible by participating in something that's really gonna not be good for anybody ultimately.
Thanks, Hannah. Tara, do you want to respond to either of what they've said or my question? Not really a question about identity and self and caregiving.
Right. Yeah, I think you both have shared really important ideas. I love how you've just spoken about boundaries. I think that's really, really important and really easy to forget. yeah, as far as to your question, Kaylin, I feel like I go through stages where I'm more productive and less productive. And sometimes that connects logically to what I'm doing in my life. Like, oh, I have all this time, I'm going to do all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it doesn't at all. Like when Evie was born that first year, like I was so tired and so like worn out, but also like my brain was exploding with ideas. And so it became a time when I was actually really productive artistically and intellectually. We started working on that book together. Mm-hmm. But it didn't seem like it would be a time that was actually productive. So I've kind of just learned to go with it. Like when I feel really interested in something and it feels really important to me, I just kind of follow that and just like, you know, go after it until it feels like too much or until I lose interest or something. And so that makes me a really eclectic artist. And I also have to like continually sort of accept that about myself. And use it to my advantage. So like where I said before, like I did ceramics for years and years and years, and I haven't really done a whole lot with it the last couple of years. And sometimes that feels sad, but at the same time, I've been really interested in other things. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going with it. The other thing I'm trying to do, like not successfully doing, but really trying to do in my life is, in academia, sometimes it feels like you always have to be hustling for the next thing, the next journal, the next book, the next art piece, the next something in the show. And with reason, I mean, like if you're trying to make tenure, like that's kind of an important part of your process. Mm-hmm. But I've been trying to let that go more. And instead of following ambition or like, I think I need to do this thing, really trying to follow what is it that I'm interested in, that I care about. Even if that's outside of something that's going to show up well on my CV, like I've been crocheting a ton the last year. I'm like a big stress reliever and I love it. You know, I wouldn't consider myself a fiber artist, but it's something that brings a lot of joy to my life. And so I'm working on kind of just going with that. Mm-hmm. And trying to accept that there are times in my life when I'm not going to be super productive and that's okay. Especially when I'm like grading papers in the middle of a semester, like not a lot of art gets made. But I can find joy in supporting students and feeling like I'm really helping them to become better at what they're doing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers your question either, Kaylin, but those are things.
Yeah. What's like coming to mind too for me is how pleasure becomes one of the first things we abandon in a capitalist society, right? Where we, you know, everything is kind of rated on success or momentum or productivity. And, you know, so I just even think of, you know, you crocheting as like, I don't really have time for this, but I feel really good when I do it. So I'm gonna, you know, I'm gonna make time and lean into that, you know, kind of anti-capitalist activity, which I think is great.
It shows a lot of compassion for yourself, which is really beautiful. I think that's kind of the element that I think of, Kaylin, just talking about the capitalist society. People don't have compassion mm-hmm. for themselves to say, you know, no, I can't do that, or I really want to do this, mm-hmm. you know, even though it's not going to benefit anybody, but it's just going to be joyful.
Right.
And I feel like as artists, that especially, I mean, for everyone, but artists, that's really important to follow what feels good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Just one or two more questions as we wrap up. I'm curious, Kate and Hannah, to know maybe something that you're working on now in your studio. You know, what is kind of like a new body of work or a new skill that you're kind of working on in your studio or a new concept that you're thinking about in your practice right now? We'll go back to you, Hannah.
So recently, I have pages and pages of these kind of thumbnail sketches of very kind of abstract, kind of bodily. And what I've been doing is transferring those to different, basically different dimensions. So I'll take them, they're very small. And then I'll make a larger one, but it's made out of paper, but it's three dimensional. And that kind of is on the wall. And then maybe I'll put one on paper. So really thinking about the shift between mediums or scale and how that changes the outcome. And specifically, I've been doing this because it's been really low stress during a time where life has been a little bit overwhelming. So this has been something that, you know, going back to just doing something that feels good, it's been a really, really fulfilling experimentation.
Kate, what about you?
Yeah, I'm really kind of following Tara's lead. I'm academic as well, and I'm trained in drawing. I teach drawing. I've been drawing over like three-dimensional forms, and I'm casting and drawing, but they're very labor-intensive, and it takes so much focus that I fell in love with like sewing unintentionally. Like I've always discovered, like with art, sometimes the thing we don't think we're supposed to be doing, like we don't even conceive of it, is like I accidentally got into a screen printing class because the other class was full. And then I realized it was just like painting, you know? And then I was like, why are we stretching it? It's cotton, we can put on our bodies. And then I just realized that there was such a bigger audience there. And I think just following the audience, but actual work, I'm taking classes at a quilt center. But I kind of steered away from
quilting. Is addicting, I'm just going
like, so I was thinking to myself, not only do I not know what I enjoy, I can't even remember what I like anymore. Like there was a moment where I was just like, I was trying to actually do self-care, but then it was confusing because when you have the constraints of caregiving, it's like the idea of a vacation isn't exciting. You have to take all this stuff with you, and then you have to plan it, and you're already planning all this other stuff. So staying in place is one of the best things for me, is like, like quiet and like alone time, as we talked about with Together Alone. Like I realized I've only spent 3 days alone in a year.
Wow.
The studio's in a community space, there's other people, you know, and I realize I never get alone time, and I can't really explore the ideas as deeply as I want to without that. But then I'm with a nonverbal person all the time, so technically I could maybe, but just the act of changing a lot of diapers and feeding a person frequently, just kind of like you're basically tracking one way, tracking another way. But all that's to say, I fell in love with sewing recently. I have become a major like fabric lover, and I wish somebody warned me. If anybody listens to this podcast, it is very addictive. also, it's kind of hard to stop. So I'm actually kind of trying. I was thinking about getting a gamer chair with like a heated seat so I can sit. Yeah. So I was like, this is got 50 seam rippers all at once. But I do want to do performance art. I'm really inspired by Jeanine Antoni and like a lot of the radical Mexican feminist artists of the 1970s. I'm getting really more interested in less product-driven art and more like out in society art. Like how do we make our practice engage that re-enchantment of art, Susie Giblick, that great book that happened in the 80s about, you know, 90s, how do we re-enchant our practice? So for me right now, I'm in this like kind of, as I'm evolving with my son, I want to do performance art. Like I really want, if anybody has a space, I'm up for it. But like, I kind of want to attach 3 G tubes together and have the pumps feeding each other and then just walk around Kroger's and see if people will help me carry the pumps. And then like symphony, like making those pumps like beep in different times, you know, and like even mothers who are breastfeeding, you know, and using apparatus on their bodies. Like I'm really interested in, like, I always kind of want to see if other people engage, like, will you grab the G-tube equipment? Will you open the door for us? Like that kind of thing becoming art would be interesting to me at this moment.
I love that, Kate. Thank you. All right. Well, to close, Tara, why don't you plug the book? Because that is what kind of brought us together. And then we'll do our final five. I'll ask all three of you to answer our final five questions. But I don't want to miss this opportunity to have you share about An Artist and a Mother, which is kind of, you know, why you and I are connected, Tara, and why we've had such a great few years of collaborating, and this conversation just being one of those moments. So will you share about the book?
Yeah, happy to. I'm so proud of that thing we made, Kayla.
I know.
And Heidi too. Yeah, after my daughter Evie was born, I just kind of found myself at a bit of a loss and really looking for the stories and kind of inspiration from other mothers. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it was just a really hard time with the pandemic and having a newborn and trying to navigate, like, who am I, you know, as a new mother again, you know, after so many years. And yeah, so I started just like looking for any resources I could find. And that's how I found the Artist Mother podcast, which has been a really big source of inspiration. And then I thought, you know, what if we made this? Like, what if we made a book that was this thing that I wish I could find, you know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, and so I talked with you, Kaylin, and my friend Heidi, who's an amazing sculptor. I highly recommend looking up her work. It's Heidi Mahler-Somsen. Mm-hmm. And together we put out a call and then curated to a work or a collection of essays and artworks from artists that are mothers. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's like going into a gallery space, like reading this mm-hmm. book, because it's mostly images. and so you can flip through and see all of the work, but then you can also read the stories of the women who created that work and what was happening in their lives and how that fed into what they were making. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's something, I mean, I've read those essays a million times, probably just in the process of putting the book together, but it's something that I still will like pick up the book now that it's a physical object and kind of flip through and find someone and read. So, yeah, it's something I'm really proud we did that thing. Thank you for joining.
I'm proud we did too. And it's available at Demeter Press website, right?
And anywhere else you can find books. Okay. So you can purchase it anywhere now.
What I love about that book is reflective in this conversation is it has a real diversity of art and caregiving experiences represented in the book and the different essays. So definitely it's called An Artist and a Mother, and you can find it wherever books are sold.
I know, what a great phrase. It sounds so cheesy. Well, and it's funny because like when I make stuff, like when I make something in clay, like the process is always more interesting to me than the finished product. Uh-huh. And mm-hmm. so like when the book arrived, I was like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Well, the kind of process, because it was like, you know, like I really enjoyed the process of meeting all those artists and working right. with you and Heidi and all of that, you know.
No, I didn't think it was real. And then like a year later, all of a sudden it comes in the mail and I'm like, oh my gosh, we did this thing. That's so crazy.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, let's close with our final five questions so our listeners can get to know the three of you a little bit better. Who's your biggest art crush? I know this is such a hard one. It can be art crush of the moment if you want. Let's start with Kate.
Yeah, I've been going to Jenny and Tony kick with that loving care, mopping the hair floor, and then the radical Mexican female artists of the 1970s. That's that, those, you know, Lucha Libre photos of the mother nursing with her Lucha Libre. That kind of stuff is really, really inspiring me right now.
Hannah, what about you? Biggest art crush right now?
I am going to combine two artists into one. I would love the endurance and intensity of Maria Abramovic. She's amazing. And then the quirky and weirdness of Wayne White, who was an artist that worked on Pee-wee's Playhouse. Big influence to me. Absolutely.
Awesome. Tara, what about you? Biggest art crush?
Yeah, so of the moment, actually, Catherine Knutson, who we met when you came out to Utah, she does fiber art as well, and it's just really yummy textures and vibrant colors, really good stuff.
Yes, Catherine's amazing. Okay, back to you, Kate. Favorite place to travel or a dream trip you'd like to go on? I love, you kind of already answered this. You just want to stay still, but maybe you do have a dream trip in the back of your mind.
No, I think, yeah, like you were going up to the mountains in North Carolina, just somewhere quiet and perspective and place to rest. Yeah.
Mm. Hannah?
I am a big outdoors person. I would love to go to Alaska and do some kayaking, some backpacking, etc. It's on my to-do list.
What about you, Tara?
I think I just got back from my dream place. I was able to travel to Italy with a group of grad students and faculty members. We went to study like a teaching philosophy in the city of Reggio Emilia, but for part of our trip, we ended up in the Alps, and it was so beautiful. Like, I want to go back. We were just in this little cabin up in the mountains, and you can walk outside and see goatalopes, which are like goat antelope. and just like the trees and the mountains that were right there. I mean, like, the mountains in Utah are pretty impressive, but mm-hmm. the Alps are like even more. Whew. So mm-hmm. yeah, I need to go back there.
Yes. You have to take me when you go back though. Okay. A film or a book that has either been a big inspiration to you or something that you're currently reading and enjoying. Back to you, Kate.
I'm reading the book William Blake Versus the World, which talks a lot about spirituality and his ways he was navigating the political turmoil of his time. But also, I just rewatched A Decent Home on America Reframed, which is just aired on PBS about mobile mm-hmm. homes in America. I highly recommend it. It's an interesting documentary about, again, like everyday lives of Americans, independent. Mm-hmm. Those are two things.
Hannah, recent book or film or, you know, kind of a lifetime inspiration book or film that you want to share?
I will say that one of my favorite films is The Thing. I really love practical effects, and this kind of goes back to the body mm-hmm. horror thing. But yeah, that and Jim Henson films.
Awesome. Tara, what about you?
I've recently been reading Kate Bear. She's a poet. She has, I think, 3 books, and mm-hmm. they're all amazing. I highly recommend. She just speaks so well about being a mom right now and life in general. Mm-hmm.
Okay, favorite meal, Kate?
This is a secret. I don't cook. Being a mother with a disabled child, I've eliminated it, but I make sandwiches, so I'm avid sandwich. I think sandwich makers allows more studio time. And
yeah, I love it.
That's not a secret to parents. Yeah.
Recently, I've been buying the like 12 pack of croissants from Costco, and we don't eat meat, but we do like cheese and sliced veggies and like greens, and I stuff it in a croissant. My kids love it. Like, they, anytime I make that for their lunch, they're like, thank you for lunch, mom. Like, they just, so that just like kind of breaking out of the traditional bread box. You can always mix it up with a croissant. Hannah, favorite meal?
Oh, favorite meal. I would say, you know, I grew up part-time on a farm, so we had a lot of meat and potatoes. It was in southern Missouri. And so anything that's kind of opposite from your non-meat eating family, but I'm like, you know, a big roast and carrots and potatoes and green beans sounds pretty amazing.
Tara, what about you? Favorite meal?
Oh, that does sound good. That's like my childhood growing up. But right now I love Indian food, and anything with paneer in it just makes me so happy.
Absolutely. Okay, and I always like to close by giving you the chance to give a shout out to somebody who, you know, has been a big supporter of your work, somebody that you're in community with who you just want to say thank you. Back to you, Kate.
My son's teacher is amazing. She has I think she has 10 or 11 kids. I've lost track. 5 are disabled or people with accommodations. And she cuts my son's hair along with teaching him every day. And so her name is Jamie Marshall. She's an incredible person, but also his nurses. He has CNAs. We're in a country now where CNAs just don't get the credit they deserve post-COVID-19. Nancy Scott is a brilliant CNA that comes and hangs out with him and dances to Michael Jackson. And then they dance, like, and send me videos of them dancing throughout the day. And then I have a dear friend, John Homley, who's a counselor and a therapist and has been really supportive of helping my art practice as well. So those really good people matter so much. Thank you for asking that.
Yeah. Hannah?
My biggest cheerleader and supporter is absolutely my partner, Nate. He is a writer, so he understands the plight of the artist. And he's really supported me through all of the different kind of facets of my life that I've shared throughout here. So big shout out to him.
Era, what about you?
Yeah, I have to say my husband, Nick Estrada, he is incredible. He's a wonderful caregiver. And we married when my older daughter was 11, I think. And so he like joined a family that was already sort of partially formed and just like took on that challenge and has been an incredible supporter and partner. And he's also an artist, which is really fun. Like it's fun to be able to make things together. I'd also say my colleague, Mark Graham, he's really super supportive and I really enjoy working with him and being able to travel and do things with him as well.
Awesome. All right. And last but not least, I just want to have you share where folks can find more about your work. Everybody can see the exhibition online if you're not an upcoming resident coming to Stay Home Gallery at stayhomegallery.com. And if you click the exhibitions tab, you'll find Together Alone right there. And you can see all the curating that Tara did and the pics that she had. And you can see photos of the installation. Kate, where can everybody find you, your work? You said you're not on Instagram much, but maybe you're there a little bit. Do you have a website?
My website's just my name, katewinley.com. And I'm trying to post once a month. So this is Kate _Winley. Got a goal. It was twice a year. So there's an improvement. I have to say, I did go 6 years cell phone free. So that's how I managed that.
Amazing.
But yeah, those are it.
Awesome. Kate, thank you. Hannah, where can folks find you?
I think for the most updated bits about what I'm doing would be on Instagram. My handle is at @HR_Foster. And then my website, which does need to be updated, is hannahfosterart.com.
perpetually needing to be updated, mine too. Yeah. And then Tara, what about you? Where can people find you and your work?
Yeah, the best place to find me is on Instagram. It's the most current. And that's Tara Carpenter Estrada.
Awesome. Well, thank you all so much. What a great conversation. And thank you for making the work that you do and putting so much care and love into the world. Really appreciate you guys and appreciate this conversation. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.